Namotasa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhasa. Namotasa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhasa. Namotasa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhasa. Buddhang dhammang sangham namassami. Had a very nice day. Thank you for all your kindness. It's very, very touching. In one of the last readings from the island, Ajahnamurru, I think. I forget where these stories come from, but when Lhunpo Sumedho, you probably heard it, when he went back to Thailand to visit Ajahn Chah after the first, in the second year of Chithurst, he was raving on how great the Sangha was and how harmonious and how inspired everyone was building Chithurst. How great it was. And Lhunpo Cha just said to him, "You won't learn anything there." You get it? Lhunpo Cha. So we tend to say, "Wow, yeah, that's great." And we all want that. But if you think about our search for happiness or enlightenment, whatever you call it, can it possibly be an object or an objective experience? Is that what we're looking for? When we get something that we want, we've been looking for it, searching for it. Is it the object that's important, or is it the end of wanting? Isn't that what we're searching for, the end of wanting? And that's the mistake of the Patujana, is that thinking that because the object satisfies in some way, then more objects would be where it's at. And so the pursuit of objects is the delusion. And by objects we mean all experience, all emotional thought, furniture, new chisels, new cars. And yet, we need things, so we'll have a new truck soon. So will that be the end of desire? I don't think so. So oftentimes we are really just taken by desire. We don't even know it. We're thinking. Most of thought is driven by desire. And by desires we mean aversions too. So vibhavatana, kamatana, and bhavatana. And then of course desire gets frustrated. And it's in the frustration of desire that we have a chance to notice desire. And in the frustration of desire, if we are convinced that the way out of that frustration of desire is then to seek an object, an experience we had in meditation from a memory or a distraction into whatever we do, if we think that's the way to go, then that opportunity of seeing the frustration of desire and not going the pathway of pursuing objects, but going to the pathway of patience and non-grasping, and we miss that opportunity. And if we miss that opportunity, then the strength of that kind of desire will come up again in a more strengthened form. Because that's what we've done, that's the habit we've created, that's the karma we've created. When desire is frustrated. So desire gets frustrated, and rather than bearing witness to that, of frustration of desires like this, being patient, we move to another object. And that's samsara, aimless wandering. And then the frustration of desire comes up as anger, as loneliness, as the inability to get what you want, as depression, as self-disparagement, all manner of ways this comes up. In our task, the four tasks we have and the four noble truths, is really to first and foremost look at frustrated desire and make it conscious. If we don't do that and we just ricochet from one thing to another, then we're not really in the ball game, we're not in the park. So it doesn't have to be a big thing. It can be just frustrated with your meditation or just being critical of what other people are saying. So like we'd like all of us would like everyone to be a certain way, to be whatever. So some, you might find one monk is too loud, one monk is too quiet, whatever it is. And then the mind, because it doesn't like that, obviously it feels frustrated, and what does it do? It becomes critical or angry or removes itself from the situation. Well, I don't want to be bothered with this, running away, absorbing into something, whatever it is. So the frustration of desire is very much the way Ajahn Chah taught. That was his, one of his techniques or one of his methods. Not the suppression of desire, but just creating situations, and monastic life has that, of actually going against the pursuit of desire. And he was very powerful that way. He was very, very fearless that way, and very few monks would do that, especially in the West. Very few monks are interested in doing that, and I don't think Western disciples would actually. I think they leave, certainly. But, so in our life here, we have much more opportunity for fulfilling desire than that existed in Thailand at the time I was there. Much more food, much richer cultural experiences, much richer ways of engaging the intellect. Heck of a lot of coffee, and so on and so forth. So the avenues to fulfill desire are limited, but they are much, much more available, say, than a forced monastery in Thailand in those days. Even in Thailand now, the opportunities are more because it's a richer culture, and that's just the way it is. So the way one operates in this monastery really is very personal that way. We have boundaries, so the very obvious ones are that we live celibate, that we have our Vinaya discipline, that we have our hierarchy, that we have duties and responsibilities, that we have routines that we are expected to go to. So those are places where you can look at wanting and not wanting. So wanting to go to a puja or not to go to a puja, or not wanting to do a job or wanting to do a job. They're little things, but if you keep attention on the frustration of desire, and you keep your eye on that, you get better and better at it, then that leads to the end of desire. And in the ending of desire, that's what we're really looking for. That's what the Buddha suggested. Our search for happiness comes in the end of desire rather than in getting some perceived experience of what we want. It's not the worldly way. Yeah. We can do ascetic practices if we want. But how do you counter that in your own practice? Do you frustrate desire deliberately? Or is the life frustrating enough that you don't need to frustrate it? For some it is, for some it isn't. One of the ways we, I would think, go against desires is we try to do formal practice, because formal practice requires some quite a lot of self-discipline. When we don't have a retreat, we don't have a structure, to actually not just fill up the time that comes to us that where we're not engaged in a group activity, to create some space there where we're doing formal practice. That's one way to go against desire. Because formal practice isn't very exciting, it's not very interesting. And to sustain, like you have to do a 10-day retreat, yeah, it's quite nice to do, but to do a day in and day out for years and years and years and years is a kind of discipline that goes against the more interesting way of like absorbing into whatever you like to absorb into. So do reflect on that. Try to, the times you have in the afternoon, try to really develop more formal practice. I shouldn't say that, but look at how much formal practice you're doing and see. So is that like, how am I using that time? And might I like put more effort into like sitting in an afternoon or doing walking meditation for some period of time? So do try to do that. I realize we all have duties and responsibilities and there are things to do in the afternoon, but try to look at that. Is there like a period of time or the one prop when or the work periods when we don't have work periods? How do you spend your time there? Formal practice is very, very, very useful, very important, and it goes against desire. So going against desire is also frustrating desire, isn't it? You're doing it deliberately. It's not huge, but it has an effect. And of course, one of the ways we do that is that we make adhidhana. We make determinations to go against some desire pattern that we have. Not in a way of self-mortification, but in the way of investigation. You've got to look at the activity that we're doing and understand desire and the frustration of desire and the end of desire. The end of desire. With each other, if we're like feeling critical of each other or judgmental of each other, to look at that as, sure, well, you know, there is training and so on, but a lot of it is just the wanting a person to be other than they are. So sometimes that comes out as just an inner judging all the time. Sometimes it comes out as sort of rude behavior or gossip. That can come out that way. So that if it's grounded in aversion, it might feel good sometimes to counter someone with aversion or gossip about them with aversion, but the result in your mind won't be peaceful. And that's the frustration of desires, aversion. So you look at that very sense of self and other, and you try to make conscious the other's behavior. And if it's within our norms, and then you can look at the very sense of wanting the person to be other than you are, because that defines both you and them, doesn't it? And as you look at that, and not just believe in it, you're frustrating desire by looking at this annoyance or aversion at someone, aren't you? So you're not just following the easiest way to criticize them and judge them and gossip about them, but you're actually looking at, why do I resist this person's behavior? And if it's outside of our usual norms, then we talk about it in either personally or in the Patimokkha or whatever. But a lot of it is just dosa coming into consciousness, because the that's what the mind does. It goes out and it judges, because it wants the objective world to be a certain way, and then we're conditioned to see, well, the objective world should be this way. and you should be that way, and the monastery should be this way, and the abbot should be this way, and the anagarika should be this way, and so on and so forth. And to see that mind which creates self and other, and to make it conscious, not to be afraid of it, and, but no longer believe in it, is the frustration of desire. Because desire is saying to you, well, if that guy changes, then I'll be happy. And then the monastery will be great. You know, well, I won't suffer. Or if that guy wasn't here, I wouldn't suffer. Or if that guy, well, you know, acted differently, talked differently, did more, did less, then I'd be all right. And so there's aversion. It's not so conscious. Obviously, you know, we're not so conscious of it because we just jump into modes of criticism and aversion in ways that are not quick. They're very quick. That's one way that we can frustrate desires, by awakening to aversion as an object and not becoming the subject of that belief system, that kind of projection that we put onto each other. Time is, of course, the great conveyor of desire. So the mind always moving to the future. This kind of constant sense of becoming, or even your meditation, trying to find an experience, looking for an experience, or trying to reproduce an experience you had last time or last year. So in meditation, very, very important to contemplate the timeless, man's curiosity searches past and future and clings to that dimension, but to apprehend the intersection of the timeless with time is the occupation of a saint. No occupation either, but a life lived in love, ardor, selflessness, and self-surrender. You know, this intersection of the timeless with time is something that is what spiritual life is about. And the desire is always about time, isn't it? You think about how resentment works. Say if someone did you a bad turn, and then later on that memory comes up of having been hurt by someone, insulted or belittled, whatever it is. And that memory is very unpleasant. It's very unpleasant. And rather than be with the unpleasantness of that, there's desire to get rid of it. And what do? We blame. And that's called resentment. We blame the person and we think averse thoughts, and we feel very justified, and others will agree with you because it was true. But we've ensnared ourselves in self-view, self and other. That's time, that's memory. And it's very real in a sense that, you know, memory is real, but the creation of a self, that's not real. That's not necessary. So we awaken our resentments this way. And the future, so if you've had a run-in with someone and some negativity, then you think, oh, what am I going to say to him? Or I've got to say something, or I don't want to see him again. Oh God, I have to go to puja. And the mind starts to think of the future and having to relate to this person where there's been some negativity. And that's time, isn't it? And that's craving, the fearfulness, the anxiety, the what am I going to do, trying to figure it out. That's craving, time. So in meditation, one of the things we're really trying to do is really to look at that whole movement of past and future and go beyond it, at least in one sitting. By beyond it, I mean you're continually remembering the present moment, cutting through the sense of time that's created in thought by knowing the way things are, the breath or just suchness, whatever it is. And if we do that in a meditation, rather than trying to get some experience in meditation or attain to something, but rather just keep it quite simple and look at present moment awareness as a training, then there's a lot of power in that half an hour of meditation. There's a lot of power than which then highlights for you during the day this how sense of self is created in time, constant. Yeah? And then all the anticipations or worries or fears or resentments or fantasies, they're all bound up in time. So you start to get a very simple method of breaking through those habits by just saying present moment awareness. You don't have to analyze them, you don't have to judge them, you don't have to make a comment about them, just present moment awareness, present moment awareness, present moment awareness. Which makes it very, very simple, very, very simple. Now we do need to think about the future, certainly, and we need to plan, and there are, you know, projects to do, and finding the difference between functional time that we operate in and, shall we call it, ego time, self time, I-making, my-making, there is a difference. There is a difference. They come together a lot, sure, but there is a difference. And our practice of then awakening to the timeless, intersection of timeless with time, is not based on desire, because experience and getting an experience is based on me wanting something. You know, so now I'm making a piece of furniture, and that's very much desire in time. I want to make a nice piece of furniture, and I enjoy it, and so on and so forth. But the real work of making furniture is the timeless presence of cutting a piece of wood, for cutting a piece of wood, trying to do it well, gluing something up for the sake of gluing something up, sanding it for the sake of sanding, rather than trying to do it for the future. And that's very much what Sangha work is supposed to, that's what we're trying to achieve in the work projects that we do. We're trying to both get the project done, so we're not doing a kind of slow working routine that we do on a retreat. If you want to do slow walking, that's one way of doing walking meditation, but obviously that's not what we're doing when we're building something or making something. But we are putting effort, and we're trying to do it very well for the sake of doing it well, for the sake of the present moment, for the sake of doing something well. And so you learn a lot in the projects that we're asked to do. You learn a lot about trying to get stuff finished, you know, trying to get the product. And you find that it's not necessarily a good product. Quite often you have to redo it because you want to get it finished. And so a lot of our mindfulness training is around just like putting stuff back, right? Doing the work well for the sake of doing it well, moment by moment. And the habit of trying to get something finished is very strong, isn't it? Now it might seem like you're not so efficient if you really just rush to get it done, but it's not true actually. If you do something well, you'll find that each step that you do, it has a foundation for the next step, for the next step, and it's very satisfying. It's very rewarding. But when you're rushing to get stuff done, you'll find it's not so rewarding because you never did it. It got done, but you were never really, really there, and the mind gets kind of stressed. I was waiting in the car. It must have been when we went to University of Ottawa. Yeah, I think it was that trip. And there was near Russell, when we were going to make that U-turn to get back to the parking lot. Remember that? We were on Nicholas there. When we were arriving at, are you there? Anyway, he was with me. But anyway, we were making, we stopped at a stoplight. And there was two people going across the lights. One was walking, and he was stressed. And Nirasa joked, oh, he's probably trying to get to my lecture. Right? But he looked really stressed, really kind of, his body, whole body language is reaching forward, like he's going to some horrible lecture. And there's another person, right at the same time, jogging. And the person jogging had straight back, and they looked really happy. And they're going the same pace. Same pace, exactly. And one was moving well, moving quickly. The other was moving not well, but the same pace. You know, and it's very much that we can do things efficiently and sometimes quickly and so on. But it can be for the sake of doing it well, rather than trying to get finished. And that, I think that's a big lesson in doing things well as craft, but also in how we approach learning, how we approach meditation. This whole idea of trying to get something finished, you know, trying to get to the end of it. And so the mind becomes, get to the end of the sitting, or get to the end of cleaning up, or get to the end of the project, or get to the end. And all the time we're losing the sense of presence. And yet, the sense of presence is where non-desire is. Desire is always this movement in time, isn't it? But non-desire, where's non-desire? It can't be tomorrow. Non-desire has to be here now. So can we work hard with non-desire? Functionally, sure, we have a desire to fix a lawnmower, and we need to, and we can't say to Vimo Kimiko, well, I was practicing non-desire, and so I didn't do it. No, I'm sorry. We're not going to feed you if you do that. So that's not it, is it? But can I do something? And obviously I want to get it done, and I want to get a good product, and so on. You can be silly about this, but there is a difference between just focusing and how do you do this? How do I fix this? Huh? Our genius from LA, he teaches us that a lot, how he can really just focus on something. I'm sure you're never trying to get anything finished, right? But there is something about work which is very, very rewarding. Like, I suppose, like, I don't know, you know, I've never cooked a meal for the Sangha, I'm embarrassed to say. But I bring in the cakes. Like, you have, what, 2.5 hours to produce a meal for a dozen people? I suppose there's a lot of pressure in getting it done, but there must be a way to do it, doing it fast and efficiently, rather than just stressing and trying to get it done. And those are little lessons, but I'm sure in the kitchen you'll see people who rush around trying to get things done, and people who move around efficiently and get things done. You can see that quality of mind. And so work in the forest tradition is very much a question of developing your inner character. It's not just like you do work and then you do the stuff that's good, you know, where the meditators really are or something like that. No, it's all very important. And then, you know, as a samana over the years, if you do develop manual skills, you know, it's quite rewarding to offer some skill to the well-being of the sangha, to take care of the requisites that the lay people offer us. You know, this is quite a very rewarding part of the human, you know, of our capacity to do things, and then that enhances the silent meditation, the formal practice that we have, because you feel quite, I would say, mature. You know, it's not like one's waiting for someone else to do this. No, I'll take it on, I'll try to do this, I'll try to get it fixed or whatever. So then you feel very much like a mature member of a society, rather than someone who is always kind of dependent on everyone else or something. As samanas, we live dependent on others, certainly for our four requisites, but that doesn't have to be infantile. You know, it can be humble, and then we ourselves, we can kind of contribute. What can I do? How can I do it well? And then how can I do it so that it at the end of the day there's a sense of fulfillment, because I've done whatever I had to do well, rather than a sense of kind of rushing to the next event. That doesn't really produce good results. So do look at your work habits. Do look at when you're sometimes people are searching for a screwdriver or a screw, and You know, sometimes you can see they I mean, that's all, their whole mind is, how can I get this thing? And I do that too. But that's a very suffering state of mind. And the mind can stop and say, well, what do I really need now? I need number 8 screw, and it needs to be 2.5 inches. Where are they? You find it much more quickly. Much more quickly. So this might sound very idealistic, but it's this continual awakening to these little habits that begins to illuminate the desire mind. Not just the kind of obvious desires of sexual desire or you know, these very strong desires, but it's this kind of the mind, this sense of bhava and vibhava that goes on in the mind all the time, becoming and getting rid of and struggling. And the awakened mind, non-desire, non-becoming, non-aversion, non-rejection, non-resistance, all this. Yeah. These are very beautiful states of mind. We couch them in the negative or in the absence of, rather than the non-desire. So it doesn't sound very, very exciting, but isn't that what we're really seeking? Like if you could get everything you wanted and you could be free of anger, I'd go for free of anger. Because I know that every time I get something, I want something else. So is that, you know, are we looking, like if you're going back to the theme, like of annoyance or aversion towards each other, is that, where's freedom there? Is freedom that everyone else behaves the way I want them to? Or is freedom lie in non-aversion? I think I'd choose a non-aversion. Because the other won't work. No, the other one. And that's to me what the third noble truth or cessation or nirodha is saying, that you know, our real home is non-desire, non-becoming. So when we couch it in terms of like when we use words like cessation, it sounds like you know you reach some cliff edge and then you're off and that's never have any desire. Maybe that works that way. But also it does work in terms of noticing non-desire. So just like waiting for the meal, you know, waiting around, hearing me tell jokes, or tell the same story again and again, poor guys. And then the mind just starts to think or whatever, but just like to brighten the mind in those times of waiting, non-desire, no thought, not the future. No time. And these times where one is waiting for something to begin or waiting for something to end, the mind just usually, you know, can very easily just pick up thought. Go with the worry, go with the resentment, go with the fantasy, but actually using those times of awakening, non-desire. What would non-desire feel like? Non-resistance. What would that feel like? So this sense of inquiry, Dhamma Vijaya, is a very brightening kind of possibility in our conscious experience, because habit is very dulling, isn't it? It's blah, 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 blah. And then aversion is very dulling too. You're just trying to get rid of the blah, blah, blah. That doesn't work. But brightening the mind with a question, what does non-desire feel like? And you're not looking for an answer in thought. You're just noticing. And that's the reflective mind. And that might apply to whatever habits you have. You know, that kind of question, like, what does resentment feel like? And then you're awake to resentment rather than resenting. What does the future feel like? When is the future? And these kinds of questions. So, yeah, the practice, you know, the practice is 24/7, isn't it? But the idea of forced monasticism is to really integrate everything all the time into this liberation of the heart from desire. And it's when we really awaken is when desire is frustrated. And that's the point. That's the point. Are we interested in non-desire? In the frustration of desire? Or do we make a choice to desire? And right there is the point of liberation or of further embedding in the whole samsaric cycle. All right, I'll leave that for your reflection.